for the entire week. And this is basically about early jazz and ragtime with some digression, but that's what we're doing this morning. And just to get warmed up, I'll start with a piece of music by Scott Joplin, a great ragtime composer. And this is called Maple Leaf Rag, which everybody's heard before. Some of you even heard me play it before. So here it is again. Maple Leaf Rag, published in 1899. Well, thank you. And that is, in fact, Scott Joplin's number from 1899. Joplin was from Texarkana, down that way, and he was born in what turns out to be 1867. Everybody used to think it was 68, but if you're the kind of person who's keeping track, no, 1867. And by the time he published this, how old would he be then? This is 1899, so it's 33, is that right? That makes sense. It's 32.
32.
Hmm? Yeah, 32 years old. So he'd been around a while. He wasn't like a young pop star of today. That's the reason why I wanted to talk about his age there just for a second. He'd been traveling around performing, playing the piano. He'd been composing. He'd been playing in a brass band, he played cornet, he'd been doing a lot of things. And so by the time he wrote this and had it published, he was kind of in mid-career. But it was the most important event in his career, and it's interesting, so I want to talk about it for a minute, because it's really important. This one point about this is really important. That is that Joplin, when he got to Sedalia, Missouri, in I think it was around 1897-98, he kind of parked himself there for a while, and he was playing in the black district, African American part of town in some places, and there was a music store publisher there in Sedalia. Mostly ran a music store, but he also published music, and his name was John Stark, and Mr. Stark was fond of Joplin's music. He decided, in fact, and he did do this, he published this for Joplin, John Stark, and the unusual part of it was, or the part that benefited Joplin so greatly, was that instead of just buying it outright, he wanted to make a fair deal with the composer, Joplin, so he gave him a royalty. Now, this was sheet music, not recordings of any kind, of course, piano sheet music that they were going to sell, and quite often these composers did not get anything except a payment up in front, and they'd be happy enough with that, especially African-Americans, probably even more so. But Joplin had made an agreement, a signed contract with Stark for 1 cent per sold copy, which I think I looked it up, and it's about 26 cents, maybe not in 2010, but I think maybe 10 years ago or so, that was 26 cents per copy. Okay, so, and things were different then. Things weren't as expensive. He, in fact, had a steady income from this for the rest of his life, and eventually it sold over a million copies. In the first couple, 3-4 years, I think it sold something like 75,000. So it really meant that he could spend less time worrying about where the next meal was coming from and more time composing and teaching. And that was his real interest. So this is a big deal, this event, because the tune became extremely popular. Is there anybody here who's never heard it before? Well, you can't say that now because I just played it, but... shouldn't have asked. But really, I'm curious. I do run into people. Usually they're kind of small people. But it's okay, that's interesting. I guess everybody knew it really well then. And it's an interesting piece, but I want to use this to tell you what we're really going to be talking about, and that is the rhythm of this early music, early African-American stuff. That is the most important ingredient. It's a prime ingredient. And we'll have a little audience participation just to show you what that's about, but not quite yet. Here is another Joplin piece. He published 44 ragtime pieces during his career. And this one, I think you've all heard before. It's called Solace, a Mexican serenade. Even if you don't think you've heard it, you'll recognize it because it was in this movie called The Sting. And that's a whole other area about
Joplin. And I saw Aaron Taylor is also in that, from that same movie.
The Entertainer.
Aaron Taylor.
Which one?
It's also in...
Oh, that too, yes. Yeah, that was in the movie too. We're going to play this one. Joplin became pretty well known in the 1970s. But by then you'd been gone for a long time, over 60 years. Anyway, here is Solace.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Scott Joplin's piece called Solace. I'm going to play one more Joplin piece. This is called Elite Syncopations, and it's one of his really classic ragtime numbers. And the publisher, John Stark, who also published this one, was actually not only a promoter of Joplin and his music, but he was a great advertising copywriter for his own stuff. And I don't know if you remember seeing old pieces of sheet music, and some of you, I'm sure you do, on the back, there would be all kinds of blurbs and ads about things that you could find from the same publisher. And this one on the back of one of the other rags, this one was described as, he said, the syncopation in the final strain is actually frenzied. Pretty snappy copywriting there. And he said, said more, but I can't remember exactly. Sorry, I usually remember that. But you see, what I think audiences usually like a certain amount of frenzy in a performance, so it should work out. Okay. Now, I want to play something. You have to leave pretty soon, don't you?
It's all right.
Is it? You got 5 minutes or something like that. I got to talk for a minute, but I want to play that so that we get it in today. First of all, let me tell you a little something about why I'm starting with ragtime. It's because it's a perfect illustration of what's going on in this music. And the rhythm, as I said, is a big, big part of it. In fact, it's to me, it's the most important thing. It's the thing that really compelled me to take such an interest in this music, I think. As a kid, I can remember keeping time to my father's record collection. The music he liked was 1940s stuff because he was that was the pop music of his day, but it really was not that different from this. A lot of it was really jazz, and it was the rhythm. Boy, that just really nailed me, and I really think this is a good way to start with ragtime because the left hand is keeping that strong rhythm. At least it's supposed to be doing that. And then that's the job for the left hand, so it's pretty obvious that that's where that is. In the right hand, we've got, it's not only playing melody, but it's doing something with the melody that's unusual. It's playing things that actually are syncopated, which means you're off the beat. You're kind of playing off the strong, steady rhythm in the left hand with this. Other things, other accents in different places, and that's what creates all the excitement. And I'm going to have you guys do that for me, but not quite yet, because we're going to listen to this track here. This is a recording by a pianist from Texas. It was made in, I think, 1926. And her name was Arizona Drains. And the reason we're playing it is because it is sacred music, and that is an underlying theme, actually, for what we're doing this week. I just look at this to get her dates. Yes, this recording is, in fact, 1926, for a label called OK. She was from Texas, as I said. In the 20s, there were scouts from recording companies scouting around looking for African-American music to record. So they brought her to Chicago when they found her, and they recorded her because they were making recordings, things they called race records. They were going to sell them to the black market. And these recordings were very, very popular. They're called race records. That's just the terminology of the day. This is one of them, 1926, and Arizona Drains. She plays piano, and what she's playing isn't that different from what I've been doing here. She's got this strong left hand that's keeping the time, and she's playing off of that with syncopated fingers and all kinds of things in the right hand. And the title of this is Crucifixion. Crucifixion. She's a church musician, Arizona Drains. Thank you. precisely what's going on there. Boy, it's really got a wonderful, infectious beat as well. But it is, in fact, church music. And that's all. That's it for today on the CD. And young man has to go to lunch anyway, so we'll let him go. I'll have some more recordings, but not today. All right, I want to try something here, which I try with different groups. And it has to do with this rhythm that we're talking about. And the complicated thing about this, to try to get across to many of the audiences that I play for and that I talk to about it, is exactly how that rhythm works. Okay, so what we're going to do is do a little exercise here. We're going to count to four, and we're going to clap. One, two, three, four, and I'll get you started, then I'll stop you, and then we'll split up into two groups and try to do some accents that will make it sound more African-American. I find, and have for my entire career, that when I get out and play for an audience and we want them to clap, sorry to say this, but you guys are all pretty square. I mean, you start clapping on the wrong beats. It's supposed to be two and four, if it's a four-beat thing, but you're going to start doing it on one and three, I can promise you. That's just what happens. I mean, we got polkas, not rags, you know. So, but we're going to try it. It's kind of fun. But let's just do this really simple thing to start off, and after we get that established, I'll stop you so we can decide how in the world we're going to try to do the more complicated thing. But for now, here we go. One, two, three, four. One, two, three, four. One, two, three, four. One, two, three, four. One, two, three. Let's get used to it. One, two, three, four. One, two, three, four. One. Okay, that's good. Now, let's see, how do we do this? We'll take these two sections. You're going to be outnumbered, but it's okay because it's easy. And these two sections are going to do the one, two, three, four that we just did. And then I will start you guys on trying to clap on two and four. And we'll see how it sounds. And it'll feel funny to most of you, I understand that. But we're going to try it. So these two sections now. One, two, three, four. One, two, three, four. One, two, three, four. Keep it going. One, two, three, four. 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 Okay. Stop. Okay. See, now you're doing it. maybe we should try that while I'm playing something on the piano. Let's get that going again. Okay. One, two, three, four. One, two, three, four. Two. Okay, you're hired. Yeah, So it still has a kind of lumbering quality about it, but it felt pretty good. I don't mean to insult anybody, I understand. It felt halfway decent, actually. Okay, well, we've done about all we're going to do on ragtime today. I'm going to move to a couple more categories here. First one is blues. It's African-American music, and it's vocal music, and it's kind of hard to play on the piano if you want to sound real. You have to find some way to play in between, in the cracks between the keys. And we'll talk more about that in just a second. I'll just play a piece here by one of my favorite players, Jimmy Yancey from Chicago. Yancey was born about 1900. Used to think it was 1898, but it might not be. It could be more like 1900. They found his draft card, World War I draft card. Anyway, and he wasn't around too long. He only lived to be around 50, 51 years old. But very influential. Never made much money at music, but he was a great influence on a lot of people. Piano players who played boogie-woogie and all kinds of blues styles later on. This is a piece that he had a lot of different titles for. And let's see, which one are we going to use? How about Jimmy's Stuff, just for today? Okay, as in the interest of being more authentic, I have to tell you that I played the ending wrong, and this is what it would have sounded like if I'd played it right. I knew you'd like that. Yancey was a folk musician, and he had trademark things, including that ending, which was in the key of E flat. So no matter what key he was playing in, he always ended in E flat. It's folk music. It's a lot of quirky things going on. And there's nothing wrong with that. I kind of like it. But if you do that for somebody without warning them about it, they think you're going off the deep end or something. So, yeah. But that's a point, too, about a lot of this. I think of almost all of this stuff as folk music. I mean, as Louis Armstrong and others said, I never heard a horse play any music. So there you go. It's folk music. So that's what we're talking about. And we don't have time to stay with the blues for today. We'll do more with that in another session. But here's another strand in this fabric of African-American music, and especially these early things, jazz, ragtime. There's a guy from New Orleans named Joey Earl Morton, who, for among many other accomplishments, he was a great composer, a fine pianist, and a band leader, etc. He talked about the Latin American content in the music that he heard when he was growing up in New Orleans. He was born down there in 1890, and he heard a lot of music as he was just growing up a bit from the very beginning, including blues, kind of like what I just played, ragtime, that was all over the place, but also classical music. The French Opera House in the French Quarter was known to everyone, and the things that were performed there were so popular that if you were a piano player playing in the city somewhere, you had to, if you got a request for something from Il Trovatore or something else, you had to be able to do it. And this Latin American music was also a big part of it. And Morton talked about it quite a bit, and he said, if you can't get this into your music, then you can't really play jazz piano. And he wrote some pieces, several of them, with this kind of rhythm. In fact, he had Haitian ancestors himself, and New Orleans is a real melting pot, and it's more like a Caribbean city than a U.S. city in many, many ways. Here's this piece, one of Morton's pieces in this particular vein, and it's called The Crave, C-R-A-V-E.
Thank you.
you. Well, thanks. That's Jelly Roll Morton, and that's early jazz piano with that kind of Latin American slant. And of course, going back to something I played earlier, Solace by Joplin, that was kind of part of this African American, Latin American stream in music we're talking about as well. And I have another example. We're going to go now from New Orleans to the East Coast for a short time, maybe for the rest of the class. But we haven't got that much time left. We've got time to cover some of this. There was a guy from Baltimore named UB Blake. And he was somebody who was around from the very beginning out there. He was born in Baltimore, as I said, in 18... we used to think it was 1883. I know you love all these dates, but anyway. it wasn't. It turns out it was 1887. And although he used to say 1883, and he said he planned on living for a long time and was going to try to make it to his 100th birthday, and everyone thought he did because he passed away in 1983. But then we found out that it was 1887, so it wasn't that big a deal. it was actually, but people were celebrating his 100th birthday. It was a big event. And he was around. He couldn't go to any of the parties. He was sick. But UB was one of the early East Coast ragtime players, and one of the people he talked about and played a piece by this guy as well was somebody who never recorded and is not really well known. Nobody knows what he really sounded like, but this guy was one of these traveling pianists that used to be, there used to be so many of them, who would go around and play all over a huge area, maybe the whole country. This guy was from the East somewhere, and his name was Jesse Pickett, and he had a tune that everybody picked up. All the piano players learned to play this particular thing, but none of them played it alike, because you were also supposed to have your own version of things. So UB gave us his version of this tune by somebody who, if it wasn't for some of the pianists who were still around in the recording era and got to record, we wouldn't have any idea what the guy sounded like. And this may not even be what he sounded like, but so it is what UB sounds like when he's playing his music. It's called The Dream. Thank you. people sounded alike when they played something like that. So that was probably just one way of playing that piece, The Dream. It also, of course, has that African, I keep saying African-American when I mean Latin American, it has that Latin American feel to it. But now that we're on the East Coast, we should talk about just a couple of more key figures. One of them was James P. Johnson. Yeah, I'm going to read you something here, which means I have to go find my piece of paper. Here it is. This is a description of somebody who might have been James P. Johnson by James Weldon Johnson, who was an African-American guy who was involved in choral music, actually, and very interesting himself. And he wrote this book called The Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man. And at one point in the book, he starts talking about sitting around in this club someplace, and he heard some music. And a lot of people think this is based on his impression of James P. Johnson. Johnson, born in New Brunswick, New Jersey, 1894, it says here, which must be right because I wrote it down. And not that far from New York. And this was a place in New York that James Weldon Johnson, the African American musician, was writing in his book. He says, he began to play, and such playing, it was music that demanded a physical response, the barbaric harmonies, the audacious resolutions, often consisting of an abrupt jump from one key to another, the intricate rhythms in which the accents fell in the most unexpected places. See, we're talking about stuff like that. But in which the best was never lost, the beat was never lost, excuse me. Looks like best, that's my handwriting. This produced a most curious effect. The dexterity of his left hand in making rapid octave jumps and runs was little short of marvelous. And with his right, he frequently swept half the keyboard with clean-cut chromatics, which he fitted in so nicely as never to fail to arouse in his listeners a sort of pleasant surprise at the accomplishment of the feat there. So now, if I don't sound like that to you, it's because I'm not James P. Johnson, but... You know, just I think that's a good description, and it's colorful, which I like. Johnson was actually a pretty important figure; wasn't just a really good piano player, a great pianist, but he was also a composer. And he did not become a famous entertainer like one of his proteges, Fats Waller, because he spent his career mostly working in musical theater. And in fact, there was a show called Shuffle Along, 1921. It was one of the very first all-black shows on Broadway. And I'm going to play a couple of Johnson's tunes here that I think you guys have heard before. I'm sure you have. One is called If I Could Be With You 1 Hour Tonight. If you don't think you've heard that, I assure you you have, maybe on Muzak somewhere or something. And the other one is called The Charleston. The Charleston is from that show. 1921 show called Shuffle Along. Thank you. Thanks, Richard. I hope you don't mind that I have to. This is the trouble. See, I have to wear glasses. I'm too vain to wear my bifocals. By the way, I want to thank you for being a good audience this morning. Good class.
That was frenzy the last.
Anyway, that's about it for today, except I've probably forgotten something. That's why I'm doing this. That's pretty much everything that I had planned, but I do, you know, if you have any questions, please ask them, yes.
When you were playing the Jelly of Joel Morton, at the beginning, there was an operatic something that I heard in there.
That's probably just, it wasn't any direct quote, but yeah, she says it sounded like some kind of operatic thing at the beginning of the... I don't either. So, well, no, if there was some, that's on purpose, I'm sure. And he used to. I mean, you can't discount the influence of Grand Opera on this
so
early stuff.
Like, little yeah. quotes from different things.
Probably, or even subconsciously sometimes. Which, and I may have gotten that from listening to Morton without even thinking about where it came from. I'm not sure. Yeah.
I heard Bizet in there.
Oh yeah.
Carmen?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, that it does have that. Yeah, you're right. I should have thought of that. It is kind of like that. It is, yeah. Yeah.
Does Gottschalk fit into this story, or is he...
Yeah, he predates what I'm talking about here, which is... Louis Merle Gottschalk, who was a New Orleans-born composer, and a great exotic... wonderful virtuosic pianist. It's a long, long story about him. Yeah, he kind of predates this, but in fact, he was basing his music on African American stuff. I don't have any Gottschalk ready for you, sorry.
So, hello, Scott Joplin. How old was he when he died?
Well, let's figure it out. He, 1868. To 1917, so
and how that's
32, and add 17 to that, that makes 49. Didn't make 50.
Yeah. And he died of.
I'm afraid he died of syphilis. That's what most people think. Tertiary syphilis, I'd say. Yeah.
Those three pieces that you played by Joplin, the second one. Seemed to be more sophisticated. Were these from the same time period or stretched out?
That's a good question. And I don't. Joplin's music got more and more dreamy as he went along. Actually, I don't remember, sort of romantic or something. I think you're right when you say that. The Solace, which I played. If I'm not mistaken, I could be, but I think that was from a later date than the Elite Syncopation is the earlier one. Pretty sure that's true. Joplin wanted his music to be taken pretty seriously. And ragtime, I play Joplin and say, well, that's ragtime, but it was a much bigger thing than just these kind of jewel-like crystalline compositions that Joplin wrote, which were beautiful. But Joplin was fighting... certain things for his entire career. He didn't want people to buy his pieces, such as Maple Leaf, and not play them as written. And yet, all the professional pianists certainly would do that immediately, because that's just how you did it. If you ask some of the other veterans, like U.B. Blake from the East Coast, that he said, well, okay. And in fact, it's a good illustration. I'll show you something here. U.B. Blake, he doesn't sound anything like Joplin. He was from a different part of the country. U.B. was from the East Coast, as I said, and Scott Joplin was from the Midwest, basically. That's where most of his publishing was done, from Texas. Well, their styles are different. But when U.B., late in his career, was lionized and... became better known based on an album he recorded for, I guess it was Columbia, wasn't it? Anybody got this? The 86 Years of U.B. Blake. Yeah. I mean, he suddenly became quite popular. You'd see him on all the talk shows on television, and there was a show called UB that was very successful in New York based on his music, and he was everywhere all of a sudden. I got to meet him myself, and you knew he was an important musician, and he had his own record label that he started, and it was a separate business, and he would record on this, and people started talking to him about, why don't you, since Scott Joplin became so popular during the 70s, said, well, you should record some of Joplin's music, and he kind of resisted that, and seemed to hem and haw about it a little bit, and basically it was because I think he didn't want people to think, when he decided to do it, that it was going to be based on the sheet music exactly, and when he got around to it, it wasn't. So I'll just give you an example. I played the piece, Elite Syncopations, and first I'll play the first part of it the way it is on the sheet music, more or less, and then I'll show you what UB Blake did with that same little section of it. That's just a trying to illustrate something that was true, and that is that Joplin's pieces, he wouldn't have protested so loudly if he didn't hear them played the way he didn't want to hear them so much. And he actually published an instruction book for how to play the music properly. But none of the pros were going to pay any attention to that, that was for sure. Another example is Jelly Roll Morton, who played Maple Leaf Rag, and we can do the same thing with that. I'll play the first section of Maple Leaf, and then I'll show you what Morton did with it, more or less. Thanks a lot. What I'm really trying to say here is that ragtime was the way that you played the piano if you were a professional, and it was a style rather than a group of, it wasn't a group of repertoire, it was really a way of playing the piano, and what the pros were trying to do was sound unique, and Jelly Roll Morton certainly was, and so was UB Blake, but that's about all we have time to do today. I hope to see you. Thank you very much. Very much.